Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Hey, wherever you are right now, fasten your seatbelts for today. We've prepared a roller coaster ride of mind-blowing visions for you. But that's why you're here with us in the first place anyways, right? Our episode today is a wonderful example of that. It takes us into worlds of thought that are far too rarely articulated, not because they're forbidden, but because they're rare, as in today's case, very rare indeed. They say that the present can only be understood in retrospect, and so today I can only speculate that we may be dealing with a paradigm shift, a paradigm shift in one of the most fundamental questions of mankind. How did life come into being? For decades we have learned that it could have happened somewhere in the oceans, deep down at the hot springs. Now, that knowledge appears to be outdated. A groundbreaking new theory is sweeping the planet right now and could have profound consequences for our technological progress. Our guest today is none other than one of the masterminds behind this new theory about the origin of life. And because his days are apparently longer than mine, he also has time to turn space travel upside down.
Okay, it's on. I'm going to test my... Yeah, my levels are good here on the Zoom, so...
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Bruce Damer, astrobiologist and multifaceted scientist from the University of Santa Cruz, California.
Well, yeah, in the spring of 1969, two important things happened for me. I got my first bicycle, and I was riding it through the slushy snow in our town in Canada, and I was able to watch the launch of Apollo 9 with Rusty Schweikart, an astronaut, on a color TV, the first one in our neighborhood. So those are the two great things about March 1969, and that led to my just obsession with the Apollo missions, and I saw the moon landing in July of that year with, of course, of the crew of Apollo 11. And then from that point on, I was drawing spacecraft. I was doing all the sorts of things. And then I got connected with Gerard O'Neill's organization, the Space Studies Institute at Princeton. And I joined when I was in high school. And I sent sketches to Gerard O'Neill of asteroid mining solutions that were a little different than what they were proposing, which was to have a kind of a railgun, magnetically powered railgun to fire chunks of the asteroid off to try to move them toward Earth orbit. And I had a few different solutions that led later on.
At what age was that?
That was about 15 or 16.
Okay.
And I wrote articles about how we could use asteroid mining as a stepping stone. And then in the middle of all that, actually, when I was 13 or 14, I decided the other cool project that humans could do was to figure out how life began, how life started. And so I decided I was going to work on both of those things from that point.
And at some point, you discovered that those two goals have something in common and form an even more profound question.
Yeah, so... This occurred to me about 3 years ago after my TEDx talks. I did two TEDx talks in one day. I opened our TEDx Santa Cruz session and closed it. And it occurred to me literally after those talks that, wait a minute, the principles for the origin of life and the expansion of life into space are the same.
All right. I told you it's going to be a wild ride today. So for the next part, Bruce will take us into orbit and introduce us to an object called Shepard he envisioned at an early age to help us mine asteroids. Hold tight, my friends.
So I had this vision of like 200 years from now, if this technology worked, you'd have millions of asteroids encapsulated by these structures that are allowing us to build megastructures in space, fuel spacecraft, and feed humans in megastructure environments. So where it came from was I was sitting at a meeting at NASA Ames where, and this has been a theme for some time, can we use bacteria, can we use microbiology to effectively mine asteroids? This is a sort of a topic. And I was getting a little frustrated. It was like a two-day workshop. And they were talking about using Centaur upper stages to deliver this and that and whatnot. And I thought, this is just completely implausible. Why don't you just put a collection bay on the ISS, collect micrometeorites, take them inside the ISS, and then try to see whether microbes can eat the stuff. And I think that was eventually done. I just thought that that's such a simpler thing. And then I thought, well, why not have a free-floating platform that collects meteorites? Or why not have a bag thing that can capture? And this was what I proposed to Gerard O'Neill in the 70s, a bag that can capture an asteroid in it. A small one, a small rock. And then I thought, well, why not encapsulate, go out to a larger rock and encapsulate with a bag? And then we did a lot of computer graphics engineering treatments. And at the Contact conference in 2019, I was standing outside the hotel and there was this tall, lanky Dutch guy named Peter Janiskens without a badge. And he was a replacement speaker from SETI Institute. And I said, well, here, you want to take a look at my asteroid idea? And I showed it to him, and he said, that'll never work. That'll never work. And I said, well, how do you know? And he said, well, I'm an asteroid astronomer. That I do for a job. And then he said, let's go to lunch. And we went down to the fish restaurant, had a bowl of clam chowder. And halfway through the bowl of clam chowder, Peter looked up and said, I figured out how to make it work. We don't try to get the gases off the asteroid initially. We bring a load of gas and introduce it into the enclosure. And within 24 hours, we can detumble them, stop them, and then we can use waves of gas through the same pump system to push them. And he said, I'm Dutch, and my whole civilization is influenced by sailing, right? We're a sailing nation. For me, we've just created the sailing ship of space, but we're moving the asteroid around. And then in the subsequent months, with Julian Knott, the great balloon designer, pulled in, we came up with this system to deploy the fabric and have it cinched down on a plug with ropes, with Vectran ropes, basically balloon technology that could easily be done. And as we've seen with Genesis in space, with Robert Bigelow, we've seen that inflatables are very viable. And then we came up with the fuel extraction and the mineral extraction, and then the biospheres. And so,
fascinating.
And we were standing there, like kind of stunned. And I said to Peter, is this new? And he said, this is a completely new idea. And for him, as a meteor astronomer, he said, this is very attractive for me because we can bring pristine samples back that aren't affected by entering an atmosphere.
Has any of the representatives of the current space industry or the future space mining industry gotten in touch with you?
We proposed this to the NASA asteroid redirect mission initiative of years ago and got a high score. It was considered a very innovative solution. We got a good score on our proposal, but we didn't get selected. And then, of course, they stood down the whole program. So I decided to do the TEDx talk to give away the idea to the industry. Mm-hmm. So what I figure will happen is the low-hanging fruit here is the fuels. So Starship and Super Heavy can carry a fuel load to an orbiting Starship. You know, we've all seen that depicted. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, if you're far out, if you're to Mars, and you need fueling stations. Tesla couldn't exist as a business without recharging stations everywhere. So we do need a refueling system, and pulling the fuels out of the Mars atmosphere is a really problematic proposition. It's an industrial process prone to failure. What yields it will get is questionable. And if it's an automated system, it's going to go down right away. It's going to have some problem with the dust. We did years ago a lot of work with lunar regolith and agglutinates on and dust, the effects of dust. And the moon's even a harder place to operate because of the temperature fluctuations. So actually getting your volatiles off the moon or Mars is a major industrial and highly fault intolerant proposition. Mm-hmm. And so what we're proposing is, you know, for these fuels, you find a wet NEO or you go out far enough beyond the snow line to get something mm-hmm. that has a lot of subcrustal ice, that has a lot of volatiles in it. You encapsulate it. You start to relocate it if you want to relocate it. But your controlling gas, which might be helium, can be heated because you have a big enclosure and you have mm-hmm. You can simply rotate. If you, people see the Shepard video, you can rotate a dark side to the sun and gradually heat the interior. Mm-hmm. Solar-powered, light the interior. And you'll start to sublimate vapor, basically, will come off of that object and be able to be concentrated in tanks. The tanker block section, once full of say, for instance, water, can then just crack the water into fuels and then take itself to its delivery position. And then
fascinating.
And then an empty cartridge would come back up. Now, here's another thing. So a business development team came together led by Carlos Calva 2 years ago, and they've discovered the following, that the Shepard idea can be used for satellite servicing. So, for instance, if you've got a big DoD satellite, you can basically enclose it, you can detumble it, and you can use the robotic things you've brought up to fix it. If you're in low mm-hmm. Earth orbit or mid-Earth orbit, you could bring a Dragon crew that could go into the enclosure with an Earth atmosphere and work without spacesuits, without remote manipulator system, and service with human crew. And then a final piece to Shepard was a debris removal. So instead of the nets that are being proposed by Clean Space, the harpoons and all those sorts of complicated things, you have this massive enclosure. You match the velocity of the debris, say if it's a disabled satellite, you've got to get out of that orbit. You enclose it, and then you gradually start to deorbit or take it out. You could then take it down and deorbit it in the atmosphere and then release it when you've changed the delta V enough. And so it's like, so there's a group that's out there, and we haven't been that active because of COVID, but it may get more activated. Anybody listening to this podcast is welcome to join the effort for a cash business for satellite servicing, deorbiting, decommissioning, and debris removal with the Shepard technology, the Shepard innovation.
Nice.
Could capitalize the business such that we can afford to go and try these asteroid experiments.
On a scale from 1 to 10, where are we when it comes to viability and the realizability of such a project? I mean, like now we are sort of in the phase of producing the proper spaceships, the vehicles. Speaking of SpaceX, of course, and whoever builds vehicles at the moment. But where are we when it comes to becoming an interplanetary species with Shepard and whatnot?
I think we're probably 75 years out to 100 to 150 years. Because what we'll see, I mean, in order to have sustainability, in order to, like, ISS is not sustainable, clearly. Mm. Any kind of future Mars base or lunar base will not be sustainable for any length of time because you still need to get replace microprocessors and all that sort of thing. So in order to have a truly sustainable, independent of Earth presence, you're probably looking at 200-300 years of consistent testing and investment. Mm-hmm. And it's not like the Europeans colonizing North America because they could breathe the air here. They could chop down trees mm-hmm. and build houses. There were resources everywhere. We have to create all those resources from scratch. So the challenge we've got is, you know, SpaceX is on a run right now. But what happens, you know, in 10 or 15 years, whereas a, you know, as a public company, they have a bad quarter and objectives are changed and Elon is no longer with the company and it doesn't have that sort of hard driving thing. We're going to have regression of that. We're going to have geopolitical changes. We're going to have climate shocks. They're going to, pull us in different directions. So it's not a straight through process. If you have the world's richest billionaires or trillionaires behind the project, you have a, it's almost like having Isambard Kingdom, Brunel, or Thomas Edison driving this process for as long as possible, and then you can get a lot done. But there also has to be economic drivers. There has to be money to be made. There has to be a reason to do things rather than just a vision. Mm. And I think it's the settling of the New World by some Europeans was done because of religious suppression of the population, people escaping. Now, hopefully that isn't a reason by which people want to leave the earth and live elsewhere. So I think it's probably hundreds of years before we get to a sustainable place, and it will require consistent investment, not uninterrupted investment and commitment. But we're not that type of civilization yet. Mm. We're not sort of rational and reasonable with sharing a big vision for what human beings are for. You know, if human beings are for propagating this rare thing of complex thinking life into the universe, we all said, hey, we woke up one day and said, yeah, we're winning the World Cup, but we're also about this. And we all said, or at least a big part of us said, this is what we're about. Let's get on board with this.
Let's go back to Earth. And I would love to talk a little more about your central work as to how life emerges, where it emerges, how it emerges. Now, could you fill us in a little about how your approach to finding a solution came into being? And because, I mean, like at school, at university, you still get to hear that life emerged in deep sea vents, and you will have a completely different approach.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. It's a classic, what Thomas Kuhn, in his great book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, called a revolution in science, or later on the term paradigm shift became popular. So for the listeners, pretty much starting in 1977, the submersible Alvin discovered these black smoker vents, very hot water coming out at the boundaries, sort of the cracks where plates are connected in under the Atlantic or Pacific. And later on, white smoker vents were found that were more alkaline and lower temperature. And it was suggested by Jack Corliss in about 1982 that maybe life started there, because you've got chemical energy, you potentially have some kind of disequilibria going on, and you have things going on. The chemists in our field, in the origin of life field, never liked this idea. The geochemists loved it because it involved rock-water interaction and geochemistry. But in 30 years, so the chemists predicted, you're never going to get anything to work in that environment, because if you form a bond, this is very basic thermodynamics. If you form a bond and you're in the presence of water, especially hot water, it's going to break through hydrolysis. Mm-hmm. And so what the argument was by the geochemists promoting this was, well, we can synthesize any all the way up to amino acids or maybe nucleotides in this environment. They've never shown that. They've never shown even the first step in 30 years of research, in a high-pressure, fluid environment with attempting to do basically a gradient between
pHs. Still, they must have had some pretty cool marketing, because this theory found its way into our classrooms all over the place.
It did, because there was really nothing else present. So what we did around 2005, 6, and this is about the time I met Dave Diemer, there was frustration in the field because of the lack of chemistry that was viable and working. Dave Diemer in the 80s, who's a membrane biophysicist at UC Santa Cruz, the inventor of nanopore sequencing, as well as a major medical technology, he had realized that if you dry solutions down, you pull water away from the monomers and they will click together and form these polymers. And so he started doing this work. And then in the presence of lipids that were present, say, on the Murchison meteorite, he took the Murchison meteorite, ground it up into a powder, put it into an acid buffer, and there were membranes forming little compartments. So that was revolutionary work for the 80s. When he and I met, they had just undergone experiments where they had polymerized chains of RNA using this wet dry cycling in little laboratory vials. With the presence of lipid, they would get more yields, and then those vials would contain these protocells whenever they added a 10 mil back in. And so that's where it stood. And as a computer scientist, and I'm trained as a computer science complexity scientist, I looked at that system and I had come up with models for hot-cold cycling where this similar things would happen. And I had set my models at hydrothermal vents. So I was literally using hydrothermal vents as my environment. When Dave and I met in 2009, he said, that's a really correct model about the cycling of protocells and that you can start evolution, but it's the wrong setting. Take your hot spring underwater and move it to the surface where it has access to air-water interface, mineral interface, and now you can do your chemistry. And I realized he was right.
That's where the paradigm shift happened.
That's where the paradigm shift happened. Armin Mulkajanian in 2012 wrote a really important article on PNAS. Then John Sutherland around that time at University of Cambridge showed that UV light can give you the steps. It gives you the energy sources and the steps to go to nucleotides, the building blocks of RNA and DNA. And it's just revolutionary work they've done in Cambridge. And the Georgia Tech, a couple of years later, showed wet-dry cycling working with peptide formation. So the whole field, with the exception of a couple of groups of our colleagues, have now shifted completely to pools on land. Jack Szostak at Harvard, our colleagues at University of Washington, they're now considering that in order for the chemistry to work, we have to go back to Darwin's warm little pond. And Nature published a feature in December that the audience can look up. It's called the water paradox.
So the deep sea hydrothermal vent theory is outdated.
In science, if you try for 2 to 3 decades to test part of your hypothesis and are unable to do it, that clearly could be considered a falsification. So the vent community has not been able to make the molecules in the environment that they've proposed in the first few steps of their hypothesis. So they may well be looking at that their hypothesis has been falsified by themselves.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all you had to do is go look for the right spot on land. Is that the next step in a nutshell?
Yeah. So in astrobiology, there's a term called Goldilocks, which of course comes from the Goldilocks fairy tale. And they talk about Goldilocks zones in galaxies and around star systems where there can be liquid water. Well, it turns out there's probably a Goldilocks zone on rocky planets for prebiotic chemistry. So the Goldilocks zones extend all the way down. And we're coming up with a new term. Actually, we're going to be publishing a paper on this for the planet's capacity to host an origin of life. And that's a different term than the term habitability. You know, you've heard the term habitability. So the capacity for a planet to host an origin event is a newly describable thing within our field of astrobiology. And the hot spring settings, if you look at the box you need to be in chemically, you need to be doing wet-dry cycling at a certain rate, minutes to hours to days at most. You have to be a regular cycling like Old Faithful geyser. So it's acting like an engine. Because all of life today operates on cycles that are very periodic and very regular. We eat, we sleep. You know, the spring comes and plants grow and then everything is cycled. You have to have cycling to push systems away from equilibrium, away from from mush. And otherwise, there can be no chemical complexity. It's just Charles Darwin's idea. And so on land, where you get cycling, you could say that you could get them in tide pools because tides are rising and falling. However, the salt in oceanic margin tide pools prevents membranes from forming compartments. It's like try washing your hands in seawater with soap. The soap turns to curds. So nothing to do with salt water is going to work. So it turns out it's got to be fresh water for the Goldilocks chemistry. It's got to be hotter water for activation energy. And it's got to be smaller little volumes so that things get together. And that helps. It helps to have lipids. And hot spring pools are fantastic because if you visit a hot spring like Yellowstone or where we work in Rotorua in New Zealand, there's pools that are interconnected of all different sizes, and they're different pHs, and they're different chemical components. So a reaction happening in one pool can mix with a reaction happening in the next. It's like a like nature's chemistry set. It's so rich chemically that it can provide you a fitness landscape for the emergence of polymers and protocells and the mixing and what's most important, the stresses of combinatorial selection, because to get to living cells, you need to evolve a system that's pre-life for a period of time to get to all the machinery in a living cell such that one day that cell divides itself into daughter cells. And that's a lot of machinery to do a division of a cell. So this is actually this gap is what we're working on now. And we call this the progenean epoch. And it's not a geological epoch. It's the epoch of the progenote, which was Carl Woese's term for that thing that carries you from non-life to life, from a jumble of molecules to organized cells. So that's now the new fascinating target for thinking in the 21st century, the progenean period. How did these jumble of molecules cross this chasm to living cells?
Was there something of particular interest when you visited and researched those hot spring pools? Was there something that you found that made you want to learn more about those pools? Because it gave you the impression that you were onto something.
Yeah, we watched an environment that we would build in the laboratory. So we watched nature doing chemistry. So hot water was welling up, flowing down, cooling slightly, entering a little pool. The pool was steaming and then drying down. Chemical compounds were forming these margins, these bathtub rings. And then waters were coming back in and taking material further to another pool that was a different pH, maybe more, a little more alkaline. And then we realized dust was blowing in from outside, especially in a volcanic setting like Mount Lassen. And that gave us the realization that a lot of dust was coming in 4 billion years ago from the solar system accretion. And that dust contained organic compounds. It contained all kinds of material. The dust and the meteorites that were pelting the Earth were providing billions of tons of organics from the sky that would then concentrate in these pools and provide those building blocks. So we didn't have to synthesize the building blocks from a vent, from scratch, from carbon dioxide. We can get them from the environment feeding. In fact, all of the carbon compounds on the Earth's surface today were delivered from accretion, from infall. Mm-hmm. Everything. Your body is made out of things that used to be carbonaceous chondrites, plus the Earth's accretion material. So that problem was solved. And in fact, missions like 67P, the European Rosetta mission, the two new asteroid missions have shown these organics are present. And in fact, the latest results from 67P from Rosetta, 50% in the ices or in the blow off material from that comet, 50% of those ices are carbon compounds or organics. So it's like that's pretty much a solved problem And it's like the origin of life field has undergone such a phase shift. We've solved so many problems in the last decade. And the wet-dry cycling gets you into combinatorial selection and toward molecular evolution. So that's, it's like the whole thing, the puzzle was put together. There's still empty places on the puzzle. There's missing pieces everywhere, but the puzzle now is emerging more clearly. So for Mars 2020 Perseverance, we are on a team that proposed that they go back to Columbia Hills, where we found evidence of an ancient Yellowstone, and due to the opaline silica at the surface and these little nodules. And they chose Jezero, we know. But one of the considerations for the extended mission, for all of the missions, is look for hot springs, because hot springs are quite possibly where life started or could start on Mars, but also where the last evidence for life at the surface might be, because as Mars lost surface habitability, oceans dried up, there was no more hydrocycle. There would have been effusions of water through these hot springs for over billions of years, possibly carrying the microbes back up to the surface. So any kind of hot spring influenced geology is going to be a target for life missions.
Bruce, I saw you on stage a couple of years ago when you talked about the origin of life. And you showed a piece of rock, and this piece of rock is a clear demonstration and a firsthand evidence that you're onto something, because it demonstrates that proto-life emerged in those springs. Is that right?
It's an indicator. So, for example, if the listeners are familiar with a lot of science shows, cruise expeditions going to these very, very strange remote landscapes. So one of them is the Pilbara region of West Australia, northwestern Australia, red rocks. And in those red rocks, there are pieces of, it's basically the Archean crust. It's some of the oldest surviving crust from the Archean period, which is over 3 billion years old. And teams in the last 30 or 40 years have been investigating these ripples, these textures. Some of them are domical. Some of them are like little spikes in the rocks. And if you drive 2 days down the coast to Shark Bay in Western Australia, you see these rock domes coming out of the very saline waters. And those are stromatolites. And stromatolites are known to be the most abundant evidence for a macro scale evidence for life on Earth, going back as far as we can look, which is about 3.5 billion years. So in Northwest Australia, in the Pilbara and the North Pole Dome, about 5 years ago, our colleagues discovered evidence of an ancient hot spring. And this is very rare to discover a subaerial or underneath the atmosphere a hot spring. And in that was rock called geyserite. Geyserite is made by the splashing of freshwater geysers on the surface that gradually lay down the minerals. And within the geyserite, on either side of the geyserite, was clear evidence of stromatolites, of these layers, these fingerprints of the layers of microbial communities left right there in a hot spring. Now, of course, what you're seeing, this is what led to the Scientific American cover story in 2017 called it's a new origin of life. It was called the article called Life Springs. They came up with a nice title for it. So what they have found is microbial communities thriving in a hot spring as far back as we can look on land, not life crawling out of the oceans, relatively recently. And in the hot spring setting, you're seeing very modern microbes. You're seeing microbes that are doing the job of microbes today in a hot spring, such as in Rotorua, New Zealand. So microbe evolution hasn't been that dramatic over 3.5 billion years. So what we're seeing in the Pilbara, in the geyserite, is a very advanced, full genetic code life forms, single cell life forms living in colonies. So the origin of life, but what it does indicate was that life was thriving in those environments as far back as we can look, and quite possibly, therefore, life started in those environments, maybe 500 million years earlier, around 4 billion years ago.
Would those stromatolite be something we would want to look for on Mars, for example? Would that be the first sign of potential life somewhere else other than Earth?
Yes, and in fact, the summer of 2019, before COVID, members of Mars 2020 and of ExoMars, the European mission, went to the Pilbara with our colleagues from University of New South Wales and to study these rocks. Because indeed, if such a ripple rock was seen on the surface of Mars, it would be very, very convincing. However, there's a second consideration. So this was in our Mars 2020 landing site selection. We basically asked the question, given that Mars might have had surface habitability for 500 million years, did it develop advanced enough microbes to lay down those fingerprints, to sequester all those minerals, to create those layers with that gluey substance that stromatolites are made from? And because the organics are gone, I mean, you're not seeing any kind of of cellular life. And did they get to good, efficient photosynthesis to be able to do that? Well, Mars was dying, basically, as a planet. So that's an open question. So the second evidence you can look for is microfossils. They're very rare on Earth, but there's a whole field of thin slicing through cherts, many, many sections, and you find these little compartments, the little capsules, and you can do Raman spectrography on them and image the basic elements, the organics, the kerogens. And then the third line of evidence, so you need to take the samples to Earth for that. And then the third line of evidence is any kind of organics you might see drilling into rocks. But you're talking a long period of time on Mars when everything was subject to UV radiation and degrading. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really open question. ExoMars is going to drill up to 2 meters down into the surface, because if there's any microbes on Mars, they're in the wet, hot, or wet, warm, saline, rocky environments below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Let's do a little bit of a thought experiment. So when you talk about the origins of very primitive bacterial life forms in those hot springs, so how could everything evolve from that? I mean, like, what next when we climb up the evolutionary ladder of complexity in life?
So when you get through the Progenian, which we're naming as a new era or period, and you get to the point where you have more self-sustaining, still chemical eating life, so chemotrophic life like you find in Yellowstone, or you find in the deep sea hydrothermal vents, you find organisms that are living on just the chemicals. They're not living on sunlight. You get to this chemotrophic life, and then you have to get to life that can live on sunlight outside of the environment, the feeding environment of the chemistry. And so you have to have photosynthesis. And then you have enormous areas opened up to microbial communities. Still, they have to deal with the UV radiation that's coming in. So a lot of them will be living in cracks and in the endolithic lifestyle, in underneath rocks, underneath the surfaces of pools and things like that. For billions of years, they have to deal with this UV until the ozone layer is created.
Say it again. We're talking about billions of years.
Billions of years. So to get to complex life, to get to eukaryotic from prokaryotic to eukaryotic, to cells with internal organelles, with the mitochondria as the energy center or the chloroplast as the energy center in plants and algae and things like this, to get to the bigger eukaryotic cell is a long period of time. And Nick Lane, our colleague at University College London, who works on the vent hypothesis, is one of the world's experts in the transition between prokaryotic and eukaryotic. And the accident of one cell engulfing another and a cell eating a small cyanobacterium, and then that cyanobacterium adapting and still being able to live and reproduce within the bigger cell, and suddenly you have a cell that can capture its sunlight. That's a big eukaryotic cell. And then beyond that, you need oxygen, more oxygen to breathe to power more complex bodies. And that's a whole other phase in Earth's history.
It seems like you're onto something, because your work got featured in Nature last year, and that is something.
Yeah, what Nature's doing is they're tracking the controversy, because there's, you know, science journalists love controversy, as you well know. So the whole oceans versus pools, you know, salt water versus fresh and whatnot, has been a kind of grist for the mill for science journalists for some time. But right now, what Nature chronicled in the article on the water paradox in December 2020 was a full shift. They basically, our colleagues weighed in their own independent way. So it wasn't just Dave Diemer and myself proposing this hot spring hypothesis. It was other colleagues independently weighing in from their perspectives. And so I wrote to the community to show them, to talk about the article, and ask them, is this the full paradigm shift that's occurring in our community, as Thomas Kuhn described? And there was a lot of discussion. And people have sort of thought maybe it is. Maybe we're undergoing a paradigm shift like the geologists did in the 60s with continental drift theory. And that, I think, is what we saw in December in Nature.
I mean, like, what I really like about our little discussion we have here is that it produces or shines such a strong light on the fragility of human knowledge. Because, I mean, like, as I already mentioned, my kids are still learning this in classroom, the deep sea vent theory. And I learned that at school and generations before myself. So mm-hmm. I think that's extremely interesting to see and understand and develop a lot more humbleness when it comes to human knowledge. Because I mean, like, I have the impression that we live in a time where we think we know everything, but now you're telling us a completely different approach towards the fundamentals of our origins. And this is what I really, really feel very interesting as a takeaway from that discussion.
And, you know, here's something else, Marcus. And we've only started to realize this in the last 2 years. We thought we were trying to solve a chemical problem. It turns out we're solving a metaphysical problem. Because what started to happen was, I would do talks like at the Transformative Technology Conference that you attended, or other conferences. I would go out to take these ideas to the Science of Consciousness, or to the SAN conference, or to philosophy conferences, to evolutionary biology conferences. And each time there would be a crowd of people coming and saying, the implications for our field are enormous for this. And I said, well, what do you mean? What you showed here with probability shaping an interactome that then creates a memory system, because that's what we think we're seeing down the barrel of the microscope when protocells form and start to undergo selection. Probability is shaped by crowding, interaction by the connection between these protocells, and the memory will be when we get templates. And we think that those are the fundamental building blocks you need to get life going. But there's other people, Deepak Chopra, of all people, said this may be the fundamental algorithm of emergence itself. That was a comment from him. A Whiteheadian philosopher who I'm now working with said, this model basically is informed by Alfred North Whitehead's process philosophy. So we're having a meeting here at the end of next month to talk it over and write an article. And then the evolutionary biologists who are promoting things like niche construction theory and epigenetics said life started with niche construction first. And that's a flipping on the head, that a proto-niche preceded the living world. You had to have, you had to evolve within an environment that was chemically and physically managed. And so that's gone into their field. And the last interesting thing was meetings with Google 2 years ago, seeing this PIM, probability interaction memory model. They said, this is a formalism that could help us reinvent AI and machine learning, because this allows us to introduce code to machine learning systems, which could involve evolution, so that the system can learn on its own and we don't have to train it and teach it. These are very brittle systems. And machine learning and AI have had very, very slow progress in the last 30 to 40 years. So if you could marry the insights of the origin of life as sort of code of creation in a way, or a code of generation, into, you can marry it into many fields, from AI to evolutionary biology and machine learning, and into philosophy. And somebody at a conference a couple of years ago, it might have been the one you were at, asked the question, is this not a new Copernican revolution? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, if you've discovered the mechanism that lifts life from non-life, therefore that mechanism must power everything all the way to culture, finance, technology, you know, biology. That mechanism has to still be operating at the lowest level of all of these ventures or all of these inventions of the living world. It's a new center. It's like a recentering of the understanding of everything on a new engine. And so I put a little picture of Copernicus in the slides and ask the question, is this a second Copernican revolution, but based in life, a reframing of what life is, as your original question, rather than that the Earth is orbiting around the sun?
You're leaving me speechless here. We've been so the time frame was about 3.5 billion years ago. So let's fast forward 3.5 to 4 billion years. It's the year 2021, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the second question of your life's challenges and questions you were asking yourself about the viable path for the expansion of the human civilization into space. So it's the year 2021, and Elon is testing iteration 15 of his Starship, a huge spaceship targeted at bringing large quantities of humans into space. Does this answer your second fundamental question as to the viable path for the expansion of life into space?
It does and it doesn't. So, for example, Starship is a traditional, you know, hypergolic reaction force rocket, right? It's similar to rockets previously, except that it will be 100% reusable, whereas the space shuttle was, you know, 80% reusable with a huge amount of refurbishment costs and et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to lower access access to space. It also has some other unique elements to it, such as on orbit, we'll have on orbit refueling. But in order to build a solar system civilization, as Elon, his famous article in NewSpace talked about a multi-planet civilization, you need to have much more. You don't need to have just the train. So it's like if we just had the steam engine that could, and we had a track that could go across into the wildlands, it's not enough. You have to do much more. So out in those wildlands, you have to mine minerals to build more steam engines. You have to find fuel sources, water sources. You have to find ways to make food. And Gerard O'Neill in the mid-1970s at the famous Ames summer workshops asked the question, is a planetary or lunar surface the ideal place to have an expanding civilization? And even back then, he concluded not. Because of all these extant problems, you have incredible heat and cooling, heat and cold problems. You have in the moon, you have just innumerable problems. Mars, you're about at the bottom of a gravity well. You're in an ultra-dry setting. You also have radiation. You have dust. Very, very difficult problems. So O'Neill concluded that we needed to build megastructures in space because we could get energy, control our environments. We could build out our environments. And he's correct in that human beings for the last 2,000 years, our direction is to build megastructures and live in them. Apartment blocks, shopping malls, cruise ships are three examples where we can completely build out our environments and control them. And that's what we do. And so he proposed that, you know, these things like the L5 colony and his large structures. And then he got as far as proposing that asteroids would be the source material. And so I believe that O'Neill was correct. And I know that George Bezos is following along this path as well. So this Shepard concept of the fabric enclosure around an asteroid to detumble it, move it, and extract from it could be the universal way by which we solve all the three major problems: fuels, volatiles, building materials through basically an electroforming process using carbonyl gas and an electric field. You can do 3D printing inside the enclosure from a metal source. This all can be tested with CubeSats easily in low Earth orbit. And then the last one is, what if you have a megastructure? Well, what O'Neill showed inside those megastructures, he showed 1970s houses, right? And farm fields with cows, you know, and tennis courts. That's probably a wasteful use of space for agriculture. We would either do things sort of hydroponically, but then you have to build out a large structure. What you can do with Shepard, with the right asteroid with a certain water composition, maybe carbonaceous with ice, you melt it down to a globule of water. The rock will go into the center, and then you inoculate it with life, and you raise shrimp and fish and algaes and everything, and you have this world, and you have an atmosphere around it, and it's lit from solar panels on the outside or lighting on the inside, and you have a world like one of those terrariums of glass where they put some shrimp and things that they seal from the outside for 100 years. So we then can feed the thousands to hundred thousands to millions of people in space by creating small Earths. And effectively, at the end of my TEDx talk, I showed the Earth dividing, that the Earth
creating a copy.
And so the Shepard project, by creating small biospheres, a Carl Sagan type biosphere, is it's doing its own mitosis.
Fascinating. Bruce, one last question that stays the same throughout every episode. And that question is related to the title of this podcast. This podcast is called Space Cafe Podcast. It's a coffee place. And if you go to coffee places, you sometimes, yeah, exactly, you sometimes might want to have a shot of an espresso. And so I would like to take that as an analogy of a shot of inspiration you would like to share with me, with the audience, of any kind of topic you would like to choose. So what's your shot of inspiration you would like to share with the audience?
Well, I let the audience know I did put a shot of espresso in my coffee before coming to Space Cafe. That's how in old Europe, the coffee houses of the Netherlands, people were coming up with so many ideas, including insurance instruments and the future. They were making up the future by drinking this devil's brew, as the Pope called it back in the 1600s. Mm-hmm. I think that the shot of espresso for me on this is something we've already been doing. The two big questions: what made us? What made us? And where are we going? If one decides to dive in, like I did when I was a teenager, into these two questions, it provides, for me, almost a spiritual path, a lifetime of meaning for my own existence and for everything I work on, became tied to these beautiful questions that were hard, but so luscious to put the mind around, to put one's life journey around, that it became like a spiritual walk of my life. And I think that the shot of espresso is that, I think it goes back to a term that you used, which is fragile, that how fragile knowledge is, but also how fragile life is. So if we put our minds back 4 billion years into those little pools and see those little silvery flimsy protocells just that look like a sludge. I mean, there's nothing more than a sludge of material undergoing some process, lit by sunlight, they're glowing. And we look at those guys and we realize how fragile that was, how unlikely on a planet with a black volcanic landscape and asteroids coming in and a moon much closer and huge tides and volcanoes. And we think, how did that little fragile bathroom sludge end up becoming the thing that transformed the Earth into a garden? And our hearts go out to it because it's like, we came from that. We came from that, how precious that was, and how unlikely we are sitting here when we came, we started that way with those frail, flimsy processes, and yet we came into being. And the gratitude, you know, almost like an awakening, the gratitude that flows in, that we're here, gratitude for them, for the progenotes, for the ones that went across the chasm driven by energy and cycles and evolution, so that we could wake up and look back upon them and tell them the following, that their work was not in vain, and that we are now in the capacity to replicate the Earth itself and spread life beyond, so that life will have a billion year history in the cosmos, complex life, and that all that work and all that chance was not in vain. We're the propagators, and we're committed.
Bruce, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're so welcome, Marcus.
That was extremely inspiring, and I'm absolutely sure that we need to call you again in a couple months.
No problem. This is what I do these days.
I would be all too curious, at least this time, to get a little glimpse into the future to find out how Bruce's approaches and research evolve. The potential is staggering. But until then, we have a few more podcast episodes planned for you. As always, find everything you ever wanted to know about the space industry but never dared to ask at spacewatch.global, and get the cool Space Watch t-shirt from the merchandise store if you like it. Mine is dark blue, and maybe I'll finally manage to take a picture for you. Take care of yourselves, and thanks for being here today.